Can counsel, can you both hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes, Your Honor.
We're going to have a little demonstration by the Supreme Court Marshal about how we keep time when we do Zoom before I call the case. So when it's time for you to start, you'll see a green card that'll say start. When you have 5 minutes left to go, you'll see a yellow card that says 5 minutes. And when you see this red card, that means stop. I will pretty much hold you to the red card unless a justice had asked you a question and you are in the process of answering it or you haven't started yet. I'll always let you answer a justice's question. So you don't need to ask for permission to do that, but I won't let you wander too far from answering the question that was asked. So with those two, those little descriptions of how we're keeping time here, I will call our first case of the day, Country Visions versus Archer Daniels Midland Company. Counsel Nielsen, you are our kickoff hitter. Are you prepared to begin?
Yes, Madam Chief Justice.
Please do.
Madam Chief Justice and members of the Supreme Court, my name is Bush Nielsen, and it is my honor today to represent Petitioner Country Visions Cooperative. We respectfully request that you reverse the Court of Appeals and make the following two conclusions. The first is that when a property is subject to a right of first refusal and it is sold in a package with other property and assets that are not subject to that right of first refusal, that the only two methods for determining the exercise price for the real estate that is subject to the right of first refusal are those methods that are described in the Wilbur Lime decision. The first method that Wilbur Lime described is that if the purchase contract set between seller and offeror allocates the purchase price between all the assets, including the real estate, that allocation by the buyer and seller can be used, but only if that allocation was made in good faith and without any consideration for the right of the holder of the right of first refusal. In the absence of such a good faith allocation in the purchase contract, then the exercise price must be set by the property's fair market value. And that's what the Court of Appeals did in Wilbur Lime.
Counsel, what do you do in a situation where there is a buyer who is willing to pay more than what would otherwise be deemed to be the fair market value?
Thank you for the question, Justice Bradley. It is possible that a buyer would pay more than the fair market value as part of a combined sale. As the Pantry Pride decision pointed out, most combined sales of multiple pieces of real estate are not at a premium price, but at a discount. If, however, there was a premium price and that was allocated in the purchase contract, then everyone, all three parties, seller, buyer, and holder, would know that there was a premium price allocated. If, however, an actual premium price was paid and it was not allocated in the purchase contract, the only way to allocate the premium as claimed by the buyer would be to take the subjective testimony of the parties, particularly the buyer. And that's a real problem because it is subjective testimony from the buyer, and the buyer has every interest in buying the property and keeping the holder of the right from purchasing the property under its contractual right.
That's all true, but if we accept your argument that fair market value as determined by what a fictional buyer in the market might pay, if we accept that argument, wouldn't we in at least some circumstances be forcing the seller to accept less than what a buyer was actually willing to pay?
No, you would not. And let me point out what Wilbur Lime emphasized, that the key in setting the exercise price is that none of the three parties obtain a windfall. And so how does windfall work in this context? The seller has contracted, as in this case, to sell four pieces of real estate plus a lot of personal property. If it sells those to two different buyers, then it gets exactly the same price. So there's no windfall, there's no harm to the seller. The holder merely gets the right to buy the property that it is already subject to its contractual right. If it's asked to pay market value, it doesn't get the benefit of a discount that was negotiated. It doesn't get the burden of a premium price paid, but it is required, so it doesn't get a windfall in any sense. Also doesn't get a windfall because it is merely subtracting from its multiple site price the fair value of the property that it is not buying.
The struggle I'm having is that the terms of the right of first refusal itself do not speak to fair market value. It is entirely based on the terms set forth in a third party offer. So are we importing something into the contract that the parties did not contract for?
No, we're not. We're simply supplying a term that was that would normally be supplied in a right of first refusal, but that cannot be supplied in a purchase contract that covers other real estate. If ADM and United had allocated a value to real estate at Ripon that was reliable and that was done in good faith, then that value could be used. And in fact, they did allocate a value to the Ripon real estate, $3,045,000. That value could be used. The thing is that whenever property that is subject to a right of first refusal is sold with other property, there is a missing term of the contract, and the court must supply that additional term. That's what Wilbur Lyman and Pantry Pride were all about. That was the whole issue, how to supply that missing term. Have I answered your question?
Yes, counsel, thank you.
Thank you. The second conclusion that the court should reach is that the value of a business that the buyer might operate at the real estate is not an alternative method for setting the value of the real estate that is subject to a right of first refusal.
And you're talking at this point in your argument about the EBDA valuation,
yes,
that was made and that was relied on the circuit court. I had concerns about that too. I mean, in my view, an EBDA value is to value the business, the health of a business.
Exactly.
It doesn't just value the land on which the business may operate. So I'd like to hear how you think we should address that.
Well, I just think that, Madam Chief Justice, you've hit the exact point, that a business value is not only subjective, because it depends on the business acumen of the particular business holder, but it's valuing the wrong thing.
Right.
I'm standing here in a large office building that is partially occupied by a law firm. You can't value this building based on the net profit earned year after year by one of the tenants in the building, which happens to be a law firm. And so every property that has a tenant in it or that has a business operating from it has two different values associated with it. There's the value of the asset of the business, that is the real estate. And then there's the value of the business operated. No matter how careful you are in valuing the business, you can never derive the value of the real estate, which is merely one of the assets of the business. Further, a business valuation depends on lots of things that the holder of a right of first refusal is not buying. And the Court of Appeals listed some of those, and all those were discussed at trial. You're buying permits and licenses, you're buying inventory, you're taking over employees who come to work from the buyer. Also, there is a hugely subjective component to a business valuation. Mr. Friedman, who gave this valuation, he said the business operated at Ripon, which, by the way, had caused the Olson brothers to file bankruptcy because it wasn't earning any money, and which had caused ADM to decide to sell it because it was losing money, could be so valuable in his race in the hands of United that it could be worth $21 to $30 million. But if that same business were operated by either ADM or Country Visions, my client, it would be worth only $8,300,000. That's a hugely subjective element. And this court has said repeatedly that the income capitalization method for the valuation of real estate, which is not the same, but is derived from income, is so subjective and so untrustworthy that it should never be used if you have the better ways to value real estate, which is a recent sale price or comparable sales.
Well, this wasn't the EBDA, E-B-I-T-D-A. That values the business, but if you're going to do an income approach for the real estate, mostly you use an NOI and you capitalize it, right?
Exactly. Okay,
so I was really surprised that this was the valuation that was put forth. I know you want to go by recent sales or comparable sales, and you want to use the usual valuation process that we use for tax assessments. You know, if you don't have a recent sale or a reasonably comparable sale, we do use the capitalization of income method in cases. But that's not what this was.
Entirely correct, Madam Chief Justice. In this case, we had a recent sale of this property to ADM for $3,409,000.
Well, that was out of bankruptcy, though. I think they determined, I mean, in bankruptcy court, you don't have to have fair market value determine fair value because it's a restricted sale. So I guess I wasn't impressed with that number.
You're exactly right. But Mark Akers, a real estate appraiser, took that value and pumped it up, recognizing that that was a deflated price. He then added the $3 million in value that ADM had added by building more improvements at the property. ADM had a book value for the property of $6,229,000. Akers' value was $7,700,000. He took purchase price $3,409,000 plus $3,000,000, that'd be $6,409,000, and added, almost $1,300,000 to that price. So he brought it back to the market value using comparable sales. That is the approved method.
I want to focus on exactly what you're saying and the circuit court's understanding of your expert's foundational testimony. This, in part, was a battle of the experts, as you've already referred to the opinions of the two experts. And in Appendix 43, it contains part of the conclusions of law of the trial court. And in number 6, he summarizes the bases, if you will, for the two experts' approach. Are you with me on Appendix 43, page of 43, yet? It's your appendix that... Okay. And halfway through number 6, he states that the plaintiff would have this court construe fair market value on an appraiser's opinion based on comparables, assessed values, and a depreciated cost assessment. Is the circuit court's conclusion of law correct thus far? That's what your expert was advancing.
Yes. In this sentence, the trial court is exactly stating the method that is used by this court and approved by this court for setting the market value of real estate.
The court then goes on to describe what the other expert witness had and what the court really found more persuasive. The court ultimately found your opponent's expert more persuasive, although referred to your expert as, I think, aptly putting forth a testimony. And the court said that it is the income approach together with some inherent qualities that would be attributable to a specific buyer. That was the basis of the other expert's testimony. And these inherent qualities the court called, based on case law, synergies, which included like the geographical location, the rail line enhancement. Did the court correctly state the underlying basis of the opposing expert's testimony? Synergies plus income approach.
I would say no, Justice Bradley, for these reasons. First, you have to remember that what Mr. Friedman valued was a business. And what he said, and the last sentence in this paragraph says it, this court finds that $16.6 million is the fair value of the subject parcel to United Cooperative. What Friedman said was the value of the business, if it were operated or in the hands of United Cooperative, was $21 to $30 million, which is net earnings multiplied over many years. So first he was valuing a business. Then the qualities that he looked at were EBITDA, which is the income method used for valuing a business. What the court said here was the income approach. We explained in our briefs that the court is wrong in saying that what Mr. Friedman did was use the income approach, which this court has wrestled with many times. But because what you mean by that is the income capitalization approach that is used to value certain kinds of real estate.
The court went on to state then in number 7, next page, that this court was concerned about the fact that United Cooperative assigned a cost basis to the subject parcel that was well less than half of what it actually paid, and the court finds that to be disingenuous. Can you respond to that conclusion of law?
Yes, and the court was rightly concerned about that. What we proved at trial, with some difficulty, was that United set a book value of all of this $25 million of assets immediately after it purchased. It valued the other assets that it bought, other than the Ripon real estate, at $17 million. It then valued what it bought at Ripon, personal and real estate, at $8.7 million. It valued the real estate itself at about $4.5 million. It then put a $4 million value on the $3 million of improvements that ADM had built. Okay, the bottom line is the court paid very close attention to Damian Gertin, the CFO of United, who admitted that immediately after they supposedly paid $20 million for the Ripon real estate alone, he valued the Ripon real estate at $4.5 million. That suggests that, yes, United actually paid well less than half of what it claimed that it was allocating to Ripon. All right, if I may. I believe that the heart of the appeals court's error was its conclusion that a business value is an alternate way to value real estate. In paragraph 33 of the Court of Appeals decision, the court said that courts use real estate appraisal expert testimony to value property in all kinds of controversies, condemnation, tax assessment, other cases. Then it said in paragraph 34 that this is a contract case where the goal is fundamentally different. The court said that appraisal concepts create an inflexible methodology. When we're more interested in discerning the likely arm's length purchase price pertaining to this buyer. Here's the bottom line. There's only one way to value real estate. And that's why all of the decisions issued by this court and the appellate courts about the valuation of real estate, no matter what the context, use the same method and the same means.
Counsel, can I ask a question of you? How much does your argument depend on the fact that there's multiple parcels involved? Are you saying this is the way it should be valued regardless? So if we had one parcel that United was willing to buy for $16 million, it's your argument that the right of first refusal should still be whatever, $7 million or $4 million or something else. Is that your argument?
No, Justice Dowd, that is not my argument, and I thank you for clarifying it. The thing is, if there were a standalone bona fide offer for Ripon, then all Country Vision's right would be is to match all of the terms of that offer or elect not to buy at that price. The thing is that in this case, there was an offer made. There was a bona fide offer, $25 million, 4 properties, $14 million of personal property. There was no price set in that contract for Ripon real estate other than $3,045,000. We did not think that that would be adequate, or at least we weren't sure that it would be, because some of what was classified as personal might be considered to be fixtures. That's why we put on testimony of fair market value, and we would be willing to accept a price that is not the allocated value in the contract, but the market value of the property. But for that deficiency in the terms of the contract, we would not have this case or this issue.
Go back to your Disney example that you advanced in your briefing. Let's say Disney, and we're talking about, you know, empty kind of farmland or vacant land that Disney was buying up secretly to create, I don't know, was it Disneyland or Disney World? So in that example, let's say he ends up paying fair market value for a lot of the parcels he's purchasing. Nobody knows his grand plan. But let's say that there is somebody who is, for whatever reason, very sentimentally attached, perhaps, to their parcel of land, and they are not willing to sell. He offers them twice fair market value. They're still not willing to sell. Don't you think in that instance, Disney would have been willing to pay 10 times market value in order to effectuate his grand plan for Disneyland or Disney World? And that's why I go back to the terms of the right of first refusal. It's quite different than appraising property for tax assessment purposes, because we do have to look at, and here we don't have terms for this particular parcel, but we do have to look at what this particular buyer was willing to pay, because the property might be worth more, as it was in the case of Mr. Disney, worth a lot more than fair market value. So how do we give meaning to the terms of the right of first refusal in this difficult situation where we don't actually have the actual term?
Thank you for the question. Let me respond in two ways. First, only Mr. Kramer, the president of United, actually testified that United paid a premium price for Ripon. The trial court discredited his testimony altogether. He was the same man who invented the $20 million price for Ripon in order to cause Country Visions not to be able to exercise. But second, importantly, this property is not Disney World. Walt Disney needed to buy all the property that would become Disney World because it was all contiguous. This property, let me point you to the record. Record 625 is testimony from trial, the first day of trial. Steve Zutz, the president of Country Visions, testified that day. He gave a bunch of reasons about why Country Visions was every bit as able to pay the same price that United would. It's the second largest farm co-op in the state. But most importantly, what Mr. Zutz pointed out is when they got the $20 million offer, the first thing that he and Dennis Halbach, the VP of Country Visions, did was ask themselves, well, what would it cost to build Ripon down the street? And that's always the dampening effect on the value of any real estate. In Disney World, Walt needed all the property that would become the entire park. He couldn't miss something that was inside, kind of like a railroad needs all the trackage. It can't have a 1 mile link that is missing. Here, you could replace Ripon down the street for $8 million. That was the first calculation that Zutz and Halbach did. Look at pages 122 to 140 of R625. That's the real value of Ripon to anybody, because United also could recreate Ripon for $8 million. It could not have paid a premium that would be more than that, because say Country Vision, say this was offered on the open market, and Country Vision said, all right, we'll pay $8 million. By the way, they certainly had the ability to pay $8 million. Look at page 120 to 122 of the record. Country Vision says, we'll pay $8 max because we could build a new facility for $8. United would get this property for $8 million and $10,000.
Council,
no break on price.
Council, that appears to be, at least what I'm hearing you, a disagreement with the facts, but not necessarily the theory underlying Justice Bradley's question. That maybe you think it isn't directly applicable here, but Her point, I think, is the point of her question is a broader point about the way we value property when you have contract terms like this.
Yes, it is. But I will say again that this court has never announced a different method for valuing real estate, no matter what the context, than the method that we have applied and that the court applied in Wilbur Lime. If I may point out one last thing in conclusion, Wilbur Lime correctly held that the exercise price in this kind of situation has to be set in a way so that none of the parties receives a windfall. United would get a huge windfall if Country Vision's purchase Ripon for $16.6 million. United bought the four properties and all the personal property for $25 million. After the purchase, United allocated $17 million of its price to the other stuff that is not the Ripon real estate. If Country Vision's bought Ripon real estate and real estate only for $16.6 million, then United would get $17 million worth of assets for $8.4 million. That would give United a huge windfall of $8.6 million. Now, United tried to engineer a windfall by setting the purchase price at $20 million. The windfall it would get at 16.6 is only slightly less than the windfall that it would get at 20.
Counsel, first of all, Justice Hagedorn, are you finished? I don't want to interrupt your flow of questions. Thank you. You submitted to this court the decision of the bankruptcy court earlier this week. Of what import is that decision to this proceeding today?
I would say in the end, Madam Justice, none, because what the bankruptcy, what the district court did was affirm the bankruptcy court ruling that the exercise, that the right of first refusal was not extinguished in the Olson Brothers bankruptcy through which ADM purchased the property. So now we have the confirmation that the right continues. It has not been extinguished.
I was wondering if that makes this proceeding an advisory proceeding. If, as the bankruptcy court indicates, there should have been no approval of the sale in the first place because of lack of notice and jurisdiction, what are we doing here?
Well, actually, as this court said in Altnow, if property is subject to a right of first refusal and it is not offered to the holder of the right of first refusal, the right merely continues until the next sale. ADM bought in 2011. It sold in 2015. We're now talking about that next sale and the attempt by Country Visions to exercise. We asked this court to set the exercise price for Ripon at $7.7 million based on the uncontradicted fair market value testimony of Mark Akers. Thank you.
Thank you. Attorney Walsh, are you ready to begin?
I am.
Please do.
May it please the court, Ryan Walsh on behalf of the defendants. I'd like to clear up what the issue is before this court. Mr. Nielsen's argument sounded a lot like an opening statement in a trial. This is not a trial. Plaintiffs, defendants in both courts below agree what the law is. What is the measure of value of one property subject to a right of first refusal that is to be sold together with other properties in a package deal?
Fair market value. In order for us to determine that, counsel, don't we have to decide whether there was, whether there were two appropriately methods of valuation at the circuit court? Don't we have to decide whether the one that your expert used actually valued only the real estate?
You have to, not exactly, Your Honor. You have to determine what fair market value is.
Well, yeah, I know, but we've got methods that we've got to look at.
Right.
Okay, I agree, this is not a trial court. We have methods that we have to look at. And I guess, you know, my concern with opposing counsel, and I carry it to you, is the EVITDA that your expert used valued the business, not simply the real estate. Is that correct?
It's not correct, Your
Why
Honor.
Not?
But
why
I
not?
Understand why you think that might be correct, because
okay.
Country Visions
I'm happy
tells
for you to explain it to me, please.
Yes, Your Honor. Country Visions says in their brief that Mr. Friedman, our expert, used an EBITDA method. He did not. He did not. He took the value of the offer on the four parcels, which was $25 million, an offer that everyone agrees was bona fide and an actual market offer, and he worked backwards, allocating the $25 million between and among the four parcels, which is exactly what Pantry Pride says you must do.
As how did he value the real estate, the individual parcels of real estate? What was his method that he used?
Yes. He took projected earnings by United, all of this is known, and he tied it to the grain capacity, the bushels per volume of each of the facilities. Now, looking at the first two, Westfield and Auroraville, he concluded that because they were poor facilities with low storage capacity and only truck loading capacity, they were worth very little. So he took essentially a cost approach to those properties. They had no possibility of earning income. Then as to the remaining two properties, Oshkosh and Ripon South, he looked at the storage capacity, noted that the cropland in the surrounding area was subpar in the case of Oshkosh, but really great in the case of Ripon South. And he determined about how much value a rail car a grain facility company could derive from those properties based on the fact that they are two grain facilities on the same Wisconsin and Southern line.
But isn't he looking at valuing the business when he does that? When he's looking at what he could make if he improved the Ripon property, isn't he valuing the business that United would have on that property?
Your Honor, our submission is that valuing a business in certain cases is the same thing as valuing the income potential as a real estate appraiser would do, but as the other side, the real estate appraiser did not do. And let me give you an example. Suppose we're talking about General Mitchell Airport in Milwaukee. They would like to lease 5 gates in Terminal A. Now, taking the cost approach to that piece of property and that segment of Terminal A, you determine how much the property is worth in general, how much did it cost to build that building? Well, that's not the value of those 5 gates in Terminal A. The value of those gates in Terminal A is what an airline could use them to make money.
Well, so that's not exactly valuing real estate, Counselor. I understand there are a lot of different ways you can value a business, whether you're an airline or something else. My concern is I'm trying to understand why you believe that the valuation based on what United could do with 100 cars a day has to do with the real estate, just the real estate, forget the business.
Because, Your Honor, fair market value is what a real-world willing buyer would pay an actual real-world willing seller in an arm's-length transaction. We, applying Wilberlime, are trying to figure out what a real-world buyer and a real-world seller would agree upon with respect to a transaction on the Ripon South property only. So fair market value and working backwards from the $25 million converge. They both focus on the same question, which is what is this very real market participant willing to offer for this property that it is very likely to buy even in the abstract because United is one of the biggest grain companies in Wisconsin. So Mr. Friedman looked backwards, applying the Pantry Pride approach, which is what Wilberlime says to do. Wilberlime adopts Pantry Pride, the Fourth Circuit decision. But we also had an expert, Mr. Finch, who said, what if you had taken the income approach, which the leading textbook on appraising grain facilities says you should do because this is an income-producing property, a textbook written by Mr. Akers' teacher. So
but
our
this
expert
is
said,
the income approach for valuing the health of a business, right?
It is
it
not.
It is not the same as the income approach for valuing land.
The two sometimes converge when the value of the property is inherent in the property. So Mr. Nielsen's example about the office building in which his law firm sits is completely inapplicable because there's nothing inherent about that office building to the Reinhardt law firm's profitability. Okay. Same with the Epic Systems example. But with an airport and with a grain facility, which you use only to make profits on selling grain, the income method and the business valuation method converge and they get you fair market value. It's to take the Disney World example. Disney World is not a normal use of the Rip and South property. In the tax and eminent domain context, you'd never use the Disney World hypothetical to measure the value. But here we have an actual third party offer on the table, $25 million. Everybody agrees it's bona fide and real. It has nothing to do with the $20 million. And we have to work backwards and figure out what the value is. And now what the other side is asking you to do is adopt a rule of evidence, a new rule of evidence. We had a 7-day trial, 19 witnesses, and CDC lost, and now it wants you to make up a new rule under which if you were to remand—
Is there anything in the record that would show that if United could not buy the Ripon property, they wouldn't have bought any of the property?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor. I mean, they certainly valued that the most, but I don't think they said either way definitively on that point. But Your Honor, I think the question is, can the trial judge, can the fact finder consider whatever evidence of value that he or she thinks appropriate and relevant as the law currently provides and as happened here? Or should there be a new rule allowing the court to consider only the opinion of a cost-based or comparable sales-based approach, a real estate approach, that is, even if the trial court found it unreliable, as it happened here, to the exclusion of any other evidence of value? And our submission is that the law as it currently exists is perfectly capable of handling this rarely occurring fact scenario. The trial court should look at anything that he or she thinks is possibly relevant. And that's what happened here. The trial judge took 7 days to consider tax value, book value, the value assigned to the parcel in the asset purchase agreement, the value under an income method real estate appraisal, the value under a cost-based approach, a comparable sale approach. We're saying that's great. Trial judge should consider all of that, should sift through the evidence and make a finding. And if the other side doesn't like the finding, they can seek an appeal based on clear error review.
Do you have a case that you can cite to me where either, well, I know this court hasn't, some court has used the EBITDA method to value real estate? Is there some case I could look at that says that that's how you value real estate? It's so different from what I understood that process to ever be used for. But if you want to, if you can refer me to a case, I would like to read it.
Your Honor, this actually tripped me up initially myself.
Okay.
But what happens to be the case is that the EBITDA method and the income capitalization method, which real estate appraisers apply, is the same thing.
No, it's not. The income approach is the capitalization of income is just the NOI, the net operating income, and then you divide it by a capitalization factor that generally represents the percentage of return someone would have to get to invest in an investment of this level of risk. So that's determined by a variety of things, but it certainly is not the same thing as figuring out what the earnings are before what income taxes, depreciation, and so forth.
I appreciate the point, Your Honor, but let me try to explain it briefly if I can.
Okay, good. I appreciate it. I'd also like a case, if you can tell me, some other court that's done it.
Sure. Any case that upholds the income approach as a real estate appraisal method, by implication, upholds the EBITDA multiple approach. So let me explain. EBITDA actually is an approach. EBITDA is a measure. It's earnings before interest, taxation, depreciation, and amortization.
Okay. Right, right.
So what the sales multiple is in an EBITDA valuation, so to speak, to use Country Vision's terms, is nearly the inverse of the capitalization rate that a real estate appraiser uses when they applied the income method. Leading textbook says that's what you should have done here. We had a real estate valuation expert who said absolutely they should have done that. And the trial court said, I agree. After sifting through evidence from a 7-day trial and 19 witnesses, this was what the trial was essentially about. And what the other side is attempting to do is bootstrap a battle of the experts, as Justice Ann Walsh Bradley aptly put it, into a question of law that doesn't exist. The question is answered. It's fair market value. And in particular, where you have a third-party offer, it's fair market value as an aid to determining what that third-party offeror would have offered in the counterfactual example where they had made an offer only on that property.
Yeah, I agree that the buyer, that someone that wants to exercise their right of first refusal is stuck with whatever the seller is willing to pay, price and terms. I agree with you that it's not just a universal price. My problem is I'm having a lot of trouble with the method that was presented to the circuit court. And the circuit court can accept whatever information it finds credible, but not if it's not based on a method that actually is valuing just the real estate. That's what's bugging me. That's why I'd love to have a case where somebody has used this method to value real estate. I couldn't find one.
Your Honor,
I come in with a question as a follow-on to the Chief Justice's question that I think might help, because I'm looking at this case, I think, a little bit differently. I don't look at this as an EBITDA valuation versus a fair market value for tax purposes or an appraisal value. Right. The way I viewed the record, it appeared to me that the trial court took into account EBITDA for United in trying to determine what United was actually willing to pay for this parcel in isolation, since the purchase price was $25 million for all four. So to me, it isn't an EBITDA valuation. That was just one component or one factor of evidence, piece of evidence that the trial court took into account in determining, which I think is what our task is under the right of first refusal, what would this buyer have been willing to pay for this parcel alone?
Right. I agree with that.
Thank you, Justice Bradley, and that's a helpful way of putting it. It's exactly the way the Fourth Circuit puts it in Pantry Pride. It's fair market value, yes, but it's fair market value pursued for the purposes of determining what the third party would have offered. And the premise of that argument is that fair market value and what the third party offered are usually going to be exactly the same. Why? Because fair market value is what an actual willing buyer in the market would offer and an actual willing seller would accept. And that is the valuation that Mr. Friedman offered. And if you get the same place, if you apply an income method based on real estate appraisal methods, which is what our two experts explain in detail. So it gets to the same place.
Counsel, I look at paragraphs 40 and 41 of the Court of Appeals opinion, and it seems to be sequel to what you are discussing right now. And that is, the Court of Appeals was concerned that the $16.6 million was business valuation that may represent something to include other than the value of the real estate. And they wanted more specific findings and therefore remanded. The Court of Appeals indicated in paragraph 40 that Friedman's own admission appeared to include all of the assets at the location necessary to generate the income that drove his analysis. So as I understand the Court of Appeals, the remand is sent back to determine or create a new record as to what is specific to the real estate as opposed to also including any additional items within the framework of business. Am I right or wrong in my interpretation of those paragraphs?
That's basically right, Your Honor, but additional items, by additional items, the court means personal property. So
yes.
On remand, we're going to figure out if the old Ford trucks sitting on the grain facility are worth anything and if they add to the business value. We're pretty comfortable we're going to be able to show them.
Yeah. Thank you for that clarification. That's exactly it. Yeah. Personal property.
If I may make a few other points, Your Honor. First, CVC's rule completely ignores the contract. the language in the legal instrument that's binding here. CVC and ADM have a deal. The deal is, as owner of the Ripon property, ADM is perfectly free to accept any offer to purchase Ripon from any buyer at any price. And although CVC has the right to be first in line, it's not an absolute right. It's a conditional right. It's the right to purchase the property on, quote, the third party terms. Now, did they have to structure the right of first refusal this way? Absolutely not. First, they could have made it an option contract, which would have allowed CVC to force a sale on its own terms, regardless of whether the seller would otherwise have accepted. They could have structured it as a right of first refusal tied to an appraiser value. We cite cases on page 7 of our brief explaining this. That would say if a third party makes an offer, the seller can sell, the third party or the right holder can obtain the property at a price determined by a real estate appraiser. Or they could have negotiated a discount. If a third party makes an offer, the right holder gets to purchase the property at that price plus a 50% discount. They could have picked a fixed sum. What CVC is trying to do is rewrite the ROFR through this litigation. They didn't choose any of those possibilities. They decided to tie their right, as is typical in a right of first refusal, to what the third party values the property to be. And they're stuck with that deal. Second, although CVC calls its preferred rule a specific performance remedy based on equity, it would turn specific performance and equity on their head. In Wisconsin, the remedy of specific performance entitles a party aggrieved by a breach of contract to a remedy that would restore him to the position he would have occupied had all promises been fulfilled. So when the contract provides that the right holder may purchase the property only on the same terms as the third party offer that the seller is willing to accept, it's the third party offer and what the seller would accept that sets value. This all follows from Wilberline, which is what the Court of Appeals understood. Consistent with black letter principles of contract law, the Court of Appeals said, Wilberline seeks to place the parties in the position they would have been in had ADM performed its contractual third party offer. This means figuring out the value to United, which we submit as the same thing.
Counsel, if I understand what you're saying is that the correct value for the right of first refusal is the real estate as a going concern, if that's what the buyer that we're looking at was willing to use it as. So you're not just valuing just the real estate, you're valuing it as what it would be worth to this buyer as a going concern. So is the right of first refusal then contained just by the real estate, or is it broader than the real estate?
It's the real estate and whatever is inherent to the real estate. Here it's property on a rail line with several other facilities on the same rail line with a 50-car capacity loading ability and a lot of grain storage volume. That's what's inherent to this property. Just like a summer cottage on the lake, it's not just a building on a piece of grass. It's a property on a lake that has value as such. So the questions, I think you can't really split them apart in that way, Chief Justice, which is why real estate appraisers apply an income method to income-producing properties. It wouldn't make sense to just value this as a plot of land with a few grain silos sitting around. To use an example, suppose you had two identical properties, Ripon South, as it currently exists, on the Wisconsin and Southern, an active rail line. And suppose you had an identical property, Ripon South, we'll call it Ripon East, same storage capacity, also on a rail line, 50-car loading capacity, but the rail line is not active. There are no railroads using that line. Obviously, the value in the two properties is different, and to not recognize the difference would be an error. That's what the trial court, after a long trial with many witnesses, understood. That's what the Court of Appeals understood. There's no clear error challenge to those findings here, which is why they should stand. We want trial judges to consider whatever they think might be relevant. And I want to remind your honors that we're not asking for Mr. Akers' real estate appraisal to be inadmissible. We had a lot of problems with that appraisal, and so did the lower courts. We didn't object on admissibility. We didn't object to the admissibility of the tax value, the value allocated in the asset purchase agreement. We think it all comes in because it all is at least too relevant to the question of valuation. And you need the trial judge in those circumstances, the fact finder, to look at everything. And then if the trial judge makes a mistake, we can fix that on clear error review. That's what the rule should be. That's what the rule is today. CVC's rule ignores that this approach has to work backwards from the $25 million. That's Pantry Pride. They misread Pantry Pride. The $25 million is real. Our expert worked backwards from the $25 million, allocating it to the different parcels. If their expert is good, and if his methodology is sound, then it should be that applying his methodology to all four parcels, you get to $25 million. If you don't get to $25 million, then the methodology is wrong. Their expert didn't even look at the three other properties. Their expert looked at Ripon South from a distance using the drone. That's all they have. Fourth, and this is very important, CVC's rule would hang sellers out to dry. Recall that this is a right of first refusal. It's not an option contract. Under the right to purchase is triggered not merely by an offer, but by the seller's willingness to accept the offer. There was clear, uncontradicted testimony at trial that ADM would never have sold to anyone at CVC's preferred price of $7.6 million. Mr. Heckman testified to that cleanly. CVC needed to show that ADM could have gotten another $18 million from the three other properties in order to do it justice under the contract, which is what we're interpreting here. Finally, Your Honor, if there are no further questions, I'll address the bankruptcy case and then I'll take my seat. We agree with Justice Ann Walsh Bradley that the pendency of the bankruptcy proceedings creates the potential for this case to be rendered moot, which is why we brought them up in our opposition to the petition for review. The other side is correct that the district court did enter a judgment last week. We plan to file a notice of appeal very promptly, and we think we have very good arguments that there is no right of first refusal in the first place.
Well, how would it make the current status wouldn't make the case moot because they upheld the ongoing right of first refusal, so you'd have to take it to a higher court. What you're saying is if you could get the decision as it currently stands overturned, the case would be moot? Is that?
That's correct. That's all I'm saying, Your Honor. There are ongoing federal proceedings that could throw out the entire right of first refusal, and we think we have pretty good arguments on appeal, and we will be appealing shortly.
You know, the federal proceedings, I thought, were kind of interesting because Country Visions had no idea that this property was a bankruptcy property, and usually the trustee in bankruptcy looks at all of the kinds of things that are filed on real estate before they end up being sold, but apparently nobody looked at it for this case because it was filed. Has anybody asked to go back and void the sale way back to ADM?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I think there are substantial questions about whether Country Visions was aware of the... So it is a bit more complicated than that. That's a
All right. question. Okay. All right.
If there are no other questions, I'll take my seat.
Why don't you stand there a minute? Because I find this case obviously fascinating. And I agree with part of what you're saying, that this isn't just the fair market value for anybody to buy, that what they have to meet is what United was willing to pay. But there's also the obligation to fairly interpret a contract. And I think the circuit court found that United didn't by setting it at $20 million, or the circuit court would not have found that setting of the price a sham, right? And you're arguing that we should take the price of $16.6 million modified, as the Court of Appeals has suggested, by taking out anything from that price that was really personal property rather than real estate, correct?
Right. We're asking you to adopt the Court of Appeals ruling on the question presented. We have some separate problems not presented here with the Court of Appeals opinion, which we might petition on later. For example, the sham transaction holding. But the sham transaction holding is interesting, Your Honor, because $16.7 million is a lot closer to what we suggested the value was for, and what we tried to buy the property for, than what their expert has suggested. So the trial court, setting aside that proposed transaction, the asset purchase agreement, the trial court looked at all the testimony from the experts and got pretty close to the number that we had initially offered.
The $16.6 million, I think the trial court took, what, $100,000 off what was said by your expert, but wasn't, what was the foundation of the value that your expert used to get to that $16.7 million? But that foundation was not simply an EBDITA value.
Right.
Is that what you're telling me? It was
yes.
Not.
Yes. In that, and okay. As I said, when your honor first asked this very good question, it took me a while to figure this out, but it's absolutely true that Mr. Friedman approached the analysis from the back end of the transaction. He took $25 million and allocated it, which is what Pantry Pride and Adelphia says you have to do.
Yeah.
And Pantry Pride says that's pretty much always going to get you fair market value if you're in a normal market. Mm-hmm. We had other experts who did what we argued Akers should have done. So Akers applied a cost-based and comparable sales analysis, as you know.
Right. Right.
And did not apply an income approach analysis,
right,
which is what his textbook says he should have done. And we gave him a hard time about that. And so did right. the trial judge. But yeah. our experts took their data and plugged it into an income capitalization method valuation. And we got to $16 to $21 million valuation range.
What was the
so
name
it,
of the
it
person?
It corroborated
that did
Friedman's
that?
Analysis.
Counselor, what was the name of the witness that did that?
Mr. Finch was one.
Okay.
And Mr. Vogan was another.
Okay. Thank you.
I would particularly recommend Mr. Finch's slides. His slide deck is very helpful in understanding.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Which is a defendant, DTX 388.
Counsel, you make the argument that the contract that we focus on, of course, is the right of first refusal and its terms. It could have been an option. It could have had a set price. But it didn't, and we're stuck with its terms. What difference does it make in the analysis that these are sophisticated parties engaging in this transaction, you know, and supposedly would have great attorneys who could negotiate any words they wanted in a contract. What about the mom and pop contract that's between neighbors? Hey, if you sell that property next door, let me know. I'll give you a right of first refusal. There might even be a handwritten right of first refusal, but recorded. Does the analysis change at all? Or does the fact that they are sophisticated parties enter into the analysis?
Your Honor, I think as a practical matter, the analysis might differ somewhat, but the presumption is that everybody who makes a contract understands the background principles that govern their contracting. So I think we'd say, even in the case of the mom and pop, they know that they can structure this deal any way they want. And if they were to give the right holder the ability to purchase at a discount or according to some independent valuation method or for some fixed sum, well, the seller is going to collect a lot more money at the front end because now what they're selling is a lot less valuable. They're giving this very valuable right to this third party. And I think that would be reflected in the mom and pop deal, just as it would be reflected in this deal with sophisticated business entities. If there is nothing further.
You keep trying to sit down. Well, I guess we'll let you.
Hey, I'll stand here all day, Chief Justice.
Okay.
I want to be cognizant
thank
of the court's
much.
Time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney Nielsen, are you ready for rebuttal?
Yes, thank you.
Please do.
Mr. Walsh said at the beginning of his argument that Mr. Friedman did not use EBITDA. Then about 10 minutes later, he said, well, actually, EBITDA and the income capitalization method used to value real estate are the same. It's one or the other. The main thing that I would note about this is that as the Chief Justice kept asking him for either case citations in which courts have used EBITDA to value real estate, he had no response about that. And when everyone is asked who testified about EBITDA and or that the method used was not actually EBITDA, he tried to give you some cites to the record, but in the response brief that he filed, he didn't even address the question. This question isn't even addressed in their response brief. the difference between income capitalization, which is the method used to value real estate by its income, and EBITDA, which is used to value a business. Didn't address it. I consider that argument to be completely waived. But more importantly, Finch and Friedman are business valuation experts. They hold no license, no degree, no certification as to the valuation of real estate. They did not value the real estate. In fact, what Mr. Finch and Mr. Friedman did, it was both the same thing. They came up with a profit number per bushel of corn, soybean, whatever might be processed at these sites. They measured the number of bushels that they expected to flow through each facility and then multiplied that as net profit after having deducted some assumptions that they made about the expenses that United would incur, because United doesn't separate its income by facility. And one of the expenses that they expected would be greatly decreased if United owned this property was that it would run a bunch of 100-car trains, 100 of them a year. On the stand, Mr. Friedman was asked, well, did you hear the testimony of Mr. Kramer that, in fact, United only runs 12 to 14 of those trains every year, combining 50 cars at Ripon South with 50 cars at Ripon North? Yeah, he heard it. That completely changes his assumption. That changes his value by $1.4 million of profit per year. His method is to take net profit multiplied by 10 years. That's $14 million difference in his valuation based on the number of trains actually run. But the point is, all of that was a valuation of a business. And yes, they used EBITDA. That's the only method that they used. They found net profit, profit broken down by bushel. The other thing that Mr. Walsh just emphasized to you four times was that Mr. Friedman worked backwards, he said to you, and he valued the other three sites, and then he came back to a value out of proportion up from the $25 million for the value of the Ripon site, the business at Ripon. He said that this is what is mandated by the Pantry Pride decision. Well, in Pantry Pride, 20 grocery stores were being sold. The court said, do not value the 19 grocery stores that are not subject to the right of first refusal. That would be dumb, a huge waste of money, and what would be the point? Wilbur Lime said, value the real estate that is subject to the right of first refusal, and it made the extra point, all real estate has a different value, so you have to value only the property that is subject to the right. You cannot distribute the overall price by acre or by any other method to just distribute out the actual purchase price in the contract, because there is no good method to do that. You have to value the real estate that is subject to the right and only that real estate. What Friedman did was value everything other than Ripon as a business and then work backwards, as Mr. Walsh kept telling you, to the value of Ripon. But in fact, his value for Ripon was he assumed a certain number of bushels would be processed at Oshkosh and Ripon. And then he just divided the number between Oshkosh and Ripon based on a percentage. And that's what gave him what he considered to be the allocable value of the $25 million to Ripon. That is not how you value the real estate at Ripon. Also, there is no testimony that United paid a premium price for Ripon. Let me remind you that ADM set a target price of $30 million for these sites. They eventually got United to pay $25 million. Because it was such a steep discount, they had to go back to the board, ADM's board, to get approval to even accept the offer from United. So this is not a premium price paid. It was a discounted price paid.
Thank you, Council. Yeah. Justice Bradley, did you have a question? Otherwise, his red light is on.
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Your time is up. The argument is tremendously interesting. Thank you both. You did a very good job. The briefs are very, very helpful and very interesting. So we will conclude this argument now so that everybody can get rearranged for our next argument of the morning. So we are adjourned.